To me, the most taboo subject in the United States today is certainly no longer sex, but class. In fact, I see all sorts of talented people devising the most delightful quack theories in order to explain the changes in American life without facing up to this abominable subject, social class. My favorite one currently is the idea of the counterculture, the idea that the country is now split down the middle. The coalition of the young, the hip, and the black on the one side, and old, traditional, conservative, middle America on the other. This theory is not only believed in by a lot of young people, but also by the supposed enemy in the business world. The advertising industry is in absolute spasm today on the subject of the youth. The idea is to find people who have a pipeline to these hairy mutants. And anybody who would like a really terrific job on Madison Avenue, all you have to do is show up with a little hair over your forehead and a pair of hip huggers. In a case of terminal acne, you can get any job you want. But if you actually start looking at this supposed counterculture, you start seeing some weird things, even on the level of hair. I can remember the kids who originated the commune life in California, namely the surfers and the hot rodders. Both of them wore their hair very long, but the surfers always combed it forward or straight down, sort of in a lank manner like this. And the hot rodders, or hair boys as they used to be known, always combed it straight back and up. And tremendous teased pompadours that looked like an 18th century peruke or a periwig. This little bit of symbolism really tipped off a class split, because the surfers were mainly middle class and the hair boys were working class. So the surfers used to refer to the hot rodders as greasers without even knowing that what they were really talking about was social class. In their day, the hair boys or hot rodders used to be thought of as a wild anarchistic force among American youth. They were the great hairy villains of the juvenile delinquency era. So what happens? When the hair boys get 5 or 6 years down the line, they vote Republican. They vote for Ronald Reagan. And why? Because the biggest thing in a hot rodder's life was owning a car, and they were early converts to the idea of private property. And so much for the great hairy anarchists of 1959. When you get to the key figures of the so-called counterculture, the psychedelic world and the new left, or the hippies and the student radicals, you're dealing with movements that are both white and middle class, but here you get a split along ethnic lines. Most of the people who are deep into the psychedelic life are from white middle class Protestant backgrounds, often from the more fundamentalist sects. It's as if they were taking something from their parents' background, something their parents only barely remembered even, and were revving it up with psychedelic drugs and heading towards some strange westernmost edge of expression. Likewise with the student radicals. With them, there's no generation gap at all. Study after study has shown that the new left is made up of white middle-class sons and daughters of people who were the radicals or left liberals of the 1930s during the Depression. They're mainly non-Protestant. They're more likely to be Jewish or Catholic. They may reject their parents' style of life as bourgeois or hypocritical, but they share their basic view of the world all the way. It is this ethnic split, which both groups are unaware of, it seems, that has kept the hippies and the new left from ever forming a political alliance in the United States. Even within the new left, there are class divisions that have crippled the movement. You go onto the campus or even into the streets, and you start seeing kids who have on gear that's so hardcore revolutionary that Che Guevara would have had to turn in his beret and get bucked down to company chaplain if he ever came up against it. They have on berets and hair down to the shoulders, 1958 Sierra Maestra style, and raggedy field jackets and combat boots and blue jeans, or these checked lumberjack shirts that are so heavy and hairy that you can wear them like a coat. And you say to yourself, these must be the people. But then every time it turns out that they're the middle class people in the movement. They're stuck back in that old miners with dirty faces idea of the proletariat, 1910 style. The real hardcore lower class youth, they aren't into the raggedy field jackets and the army surplus socks. They're into the James Brown look or the Tom Jones look, into the ruffled shirts and the black belted leather pieces and the bell cuff herringbones, all that stuff, looking sharp, you know. And if you ever try to put one of those lumpy lumberjack shirts on them, they'd vomit. As for the hair, the hell with that stringy Sierra Maestra down to the shoulder look. They've got their hair swept up and back in pompadours, either James Brown style or like the hair boys. Now, if the middle-class ideological benefactors of the street youth don't face up to the question of class in their own ranks, they're going to see something akin to the skinhead phenomenon starting here. In fact, it's already begun. The skinheads are actually English working-class youth who are on the most elaborate, ugly trip you can imagine. They wear their hair either chopped down to little clumps or shaved down to a stubble. And they wear clodhoppers, real farmer's boots with the inch-thick soles and the metal-capped toes and the studs on the bottom, the last word in ugly boots. And what the skinheads do is go around kicking hippies and students with these boots. They go around kicking hippies and students. In fact, if you're a skinhead, that's what you do. That's your role in life. That's your goal in life, to go around kicking hippies and students with your colossal, ugly boots. And there you have it, the final round, alienation from the alienated, and the broken biscuits and the penny fades of what's left of the counterculture.